From the Melanina Zuckerman College of Public Health at the University of Arizona, this is Keeping Up with Public Health Cross-Sector Collaborations.
Hi, and welcome to Keeping Up with Public Health from the Western Region Public Health Training Center. I'm your host, Allison Root. This is the final episode in our series on cross-sector collaborations, and we'll be hearing from Ruben Cantu from Prevention Institute and Melissa Jones from the Bay Area Regional Health Inequities Initiative, also known as BARHI, as they share the value of working across sectors and discuss approaches for engaging in cross-sectoral work.
Hello, I'm Melissa Jones, Executive Director at BARHI, the Bay Area Regional Health Inequities Initiative. We're an organization founded by the health departments of the Bay Area to work on the issues that impact health outside the doctor's office. Excited to be here to talk to you today.
I'm Ruben Cantu with Prevention Institute. We're a national nonprofit organization based in Oakland, Los Angeles, and Houston. And our mission is to ensure that we're building prevention and health equity into policies and practices kind of at all levels, federal, state, local, organizational level, to ensure that the places where people live, work, play, and learn foster health, safety, and well-being.
Thank you both for joining us today. We've had so many wonderful examples of cross-sectoral work in each of the episodes, and we just want to take this final episode to hear from you and talk about the benefits of this collaborative work and hear from your examples. One of the themes that has come up a lot has been being able to identify common goals and mutual benefits. And along with that, creating a shared ownership and recognizing and working within power dynamics. What are your experiences with building shared ownership and overcoming power dynamics in working across sectors?
I'm happy to talk a little bit about the work that BARHI did with health officers and parks departments during the pandemic. Early on in the pandemic, there was not as much known, particularly from people outside of public health, about what the safest strategies were. And so parks directors across the region were working to consider what's safest for keeping parks open or closing parks down, what's safest for their staff. And health officers were constantly studying the most recent data and knowledge about what was safe. And so for us in the Bay Area, an assistant health officer who understood the need to have parks open for so many families who were living in small units, needing a place to get outside, needing a place to exercise and recreate during the shutdown and the pandemic, partnered with the parks directors across the region. In fact, many parks directors across all of the counties got together and with the assistant health officer started to move through the science of what was transmission risk, what were the safe ways to keep parks open, what were the decisions to be made about how to do that. And we were able to establish a guidebook using the knowledge of the health officers and public health and the knowledge and deep understanding of the park system by the parks directors to come together and create a solution that kept our parks open in the Bay Area and reopened many that had been closed. And that model meant families all over the Bay Area were able to get outside at different points during the pandemic. Health departments, parks departments, people with a lot of authority over how things happen, really coming together to say, our goal is to have parks open and to be safe. What are the strategies that allow us to do that? Was a really powerful lesson. And it was just us really sitting around, looking at the data and doing some fact-based thinking about what was going to work best. So that's one on the government side. There's a lot on the community side as well. But Ruben, maybe you want to share an example.
Yeah, thank you, Melissa. Collaboration, especially across sectors, has really been kind of a core thing that Prevention Institute has worked on almost since the very beginning. One of our formative frameworks and tools that we developed was all around collaboration, a tool called Collaboration Multiplier, which really helped folks walk through how to develop joint strategy based on different sectors, shared goals, shared mandates, shared activity. And one of the things that's really important as you're kind of doing that work is to make sure that you call out and recognize power dynamics. When you bring folks to the table, you try to recognize that community members are really the experts in their communities and like what's going on in the communities. And they know more about like the strengths, the assets and priorities in their communities that can help us move beyond just focusing on needs and deficits. You know, my example is also kind of related to the pandemic, like what Melissa shared. And kind of about a year into the pandemic, we started working on a paper and did a little bit of research with our partners at CPEN, the California Pan-Ethnic Health Network, and Change Lab Solutions, to look at how community-based organizations stepped up to fill the gap. Health departments were stretched really thin. Like they were doing so much to try to understand what was going on, to get funding out the door, to ensure people were getting tested. And then once we had vaccine, you know, getting people vaccinated. And we really saw how community organizations stepped up and started playing a really strong role in connecting folks to resources and getting people connected, you know, to make sure that they wouldn't get evicted from their homes or had the resources to put food on their table. And to be really strong advocates for their community. We're really lucky in California that there are really strong relationships between public health departments, departments of behavioral health, departments of mental health, what have you. We've got those really strong relationships already. So for us here, it just feels like it's more about continuing to strengthen that and recognize those roles and recognizing those kind of power dynamics.
Thanks for sharing those examples. The pandemic really did kind of force people to come together more and figure out ways of working together better. Another thing that came up in probably almost every episode is being able to find that authentic community engagement and also budgeting for that within projects, not expecting people to just show up and contribute, but providing at least something, some sort of compensation for community members' time for contributing to various projects and things. What are some of the ways that you have seen multiple sectors come together to find that authentic community engagement?
I kind of alluded to this a moment ago. It's really about making sure that when we're working across sectors, whether it be local government, community organizations, to anybody else, the housing sector, housing developers, employers, transit authority, folks like that. It's really important to make sure that community members, residents, the folks that I said earlier, kind of are the experts in their community, that there is some sort of power sharing and some sort of sharing of authority with those folks because they know their community best. And by doing that kind of work and making sure that we're letting them contribute, and even just saying it that way, letting them contribute, kind of already showing that there is kind of a power differential, right? But making sure that they're at the table and that they're contributing to the development of plans and strategies and policies. By doing that, we're going to start out with a much stronger focus on equity and justice. We've seen through a lot of the work that we've done, one of the really strong ways that we've seen that come through is with organizations that have been invited in, community organizations that have been invited in to participate in community participatory budgeting. That's one way you see that's really strongly where, you know, whether it's a health department or a parks and rec department or somebody that has the funding to do some work in the community will invite in community organizations, advocates, residents to be part of the planning and the decision making around how funds are going to be disseminated and spent in their community. And I think that's one way to like really have authentic community engagement, making sure that those folks are kind of trained and have the information and have the knowledge to be able to participate in that kind of process, but then making sure that they're part of that decision making process. But I think that's a really strong way to ensure that kind of authentic community engagement.
I agree. When we think about community engagement, we think about several methods, but two I'll talk about now. One is about bringing engagement to where people are. So if we're doing planning around transit and bus routes, we bring the engagement to bus stops and talk to people who are riding the bus at different times of the day, rather than focusing on getting people into meetings that aren't part of their daily lives. And so we talk a lot with folks about how to find the natural point where people who are using different public services might be engaged to talk about what they need. The other way to do that is client services surveys to really start to understand what's working for clients and what's not in the way government is delivering services. And so, for example, there have been a series of equity assessments that have happened across the region that focus on what has worked, including things like what time services are open and available so that they're better matched to where people are. But ultimately, I think we think the deepest kind of community engagement, the kind that's about planning what's next for your neighborhood or community or strategy, is about the long-term relationship. And so there can be great ways that we survey, and there should be, so we get some broad understanding. But there also needs to be deep ways that we're in relationship. And so there have been different versions of that over time, right? Community advisory boards, community coalitions. And one of the things that I think has really endured is this idea of community backbone organizations. And that comes a lot out of the community development space, where you have nonprofit organizations that are funded over long periods of time and have community organizers and others on staff whose job it is to know and understand the community, the changes that are happening, to be an early ear to things that are changing and might need to be addressed, or a long-term ear to what people's dreams and visions are for what could come next for the neighborhood. And then to pair that with different kinds of public and private investment to make those things come true. One example is the Rhode Island Health Equity Zones, which a lot of people know. For about 10 years, Rhode Island Department of Public Health, and then the state of Rhode Island more generally, and community development organizations like Local Initiative Support Corporation worked together to fund for a long time community backbone organizations that had community organizers, did community plans, and then to fund those plans so that people could have everything from summer events in the park to new programs at the schools after school to new affordable housing or commercial space. That's a model we think is really interesting. It's a model we just brought out. We just brought Rhode Island out to the state of California to talk to the 60 new equity leads across the state that were funded as part of the state's work on equity and COVID response, to hear that kind of model that could be a long-term resilience model for California. And there are others, I know LISTS models because I worked there for a long time, but they also had a building sustainable communities model, very similar, 10 years of money, a California endowment, similar kind of model, 10 years of money to do organizing and planning, and then to align public and private resources to make that happen. So we think there's some really interesting ways that philanthropy and government can work together to make those kind of things happen. And so it can be at a very community-based level, community planning, new kinds of community projects and housing and social projects, things like sports programs and other things. It can also be at a community organizing level. In the San Francisco Bay Area, the San Francisco Foundation has funded for a number of years housing organizing groups that have bases of residents who are part of their membership base and tell them what's happening with their housing and what's needed next. It alerts when landlords are doing unsavory things. Because there was that big coalition of housing groups funded here in the Bay Area by San Francisco Foundation, Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, and others, when there was a regional housing planning process that came forward on housing, we had a whole group of community partners that we could convene in an equity kitchen cabinet, which Bar High did, and were able to come up with some joint requests to move forward at the regional level to focus on things like tenant protections, the preservation of affordable housing, and the production of new housing. That list of things then had the power to pass statewide in important ways. And so we think that kind of coalition building is also very important. So community-based, neighborhood-based improvements and policy improvements that can have population-level changes, both can be sustained, I think, by combinations of aligning government and philanthropic resources. We put out a guidebook on that called Farther Together that lays out a way for governments to do long-term funding for community groups that continue to, in an ongoing way, help neighborhoods plan their future. And so you can find that on our website,
and we can share it here with you today.
Yeah, that'd be great. We can link that in our resources. One of the other things that has been a common theme is focusing on assets and strengths versus deficits or barriers. And so I just want to invite you to share in your work ways that you've seen that focus on assets and strengths.
I mean, one of the places I've seen this work really well is Prevention Institute coordinated a learning community for about 6 years called Making Connections for Mental Health and Well-Being Among Men and Boys. The project sunsetted about 2 years ago in 2021. And basically, it was a learning community made up of 16 local coalitions from across the U.S. And they were all identified based on their experience and their relationships and how much trust they had in the communities that they were working in. And they were charged with developing strategies, both programmatic and policy, to improve conditions that would embed impact mental health and well-being in general, but also specifically for young men and boys of color. And one of the things that their first activity was to develop a community assessment to kind of identify what was going on in the community and what the priorities should be. And so many of them, you know, when we first started talking to them about this, we made the very clear, distinct choice to not call it a needs assessment, but to call it a community assessment, because we didn't want to focus just on the needs and the challenges. And when people went out and did their assessment, they tapped into folks in the community. They tapped into young men and boys to go out and talk to their friends, their peers, their family, to kind of identify what is it that we feel is driving poor mental health in our community. And while they came back to us with a lot of challenges that the communities were facing, everything from fear of displacement and high cost of rent and housing and a lack of affordable housing and a lack of well-paying jobs and living wages, they also came back to us with, you know, these are the strengths in the community. And it really kind of highlighted for us that taking that strength-based approach is the right approach, because in addition to kind of identifying the challenges and then developing solutions and strategies to address those, folks were able to identify the challenges and the strength that they could build on records to be able to address the challenges in their community. And, you know, based off of that, they were able to build some great leadership models, leveraging other folks in the community that had something to contribute or that could help folks become stronger advocates for their community, so that they could actually start seeing policy and systems change in their community, including bike lanes, including park access, including access to well-paying jobs, things like that. So it was really great to see how taking that approach helped make getting to the solution that much easier.
We've seen similar things, Ruben, to what you've seen working on strength-based approaches because of the kinds of solutions it brings forward. For us, and particularly in the Bay Area, we've seen massive waves of Black displacement, in part because people are moving for first-time homeownership, in part because people are moving for reasonably priced rentals. And so we started a set of coffee conversations that grew into a big campaign that were all about what are the solutions that we have before us? And we heard from Black developers all over the region about the kinds of projects they had in mind, the kinds of funding and financing that would make those possible. We designed a vision for a Black housing fund that ran, and in its first year as a campaign at the state level, became a top five Bay Area caucus priority in less than 8 months, which is a pretty big deal, and I think is a testament to the number of the 50 organizations that the ideas we talked about it and the focus on talking about the solutions and the visions we have that, but for the funding we could solve. solved for the issue really just brought people in. And so that coalition within a handful of months was 50 Black-led organizations. It's now 80. And I just think there's a mobilizing power of thinking about what we can do to create our new futures, both in the places for us in this particular campaign, in the places where folks have lived a long time, three generations, and the places that Black communities have been moving now for three decades as displacement has taken hold.
It's great to see something like that happen in a fairly short period of time, too. Ruben, you said something about a living wage, and there was an article in the LA Times recently about homeless outreach and workers and high turnover. There's a high turnover among homeless outreach workers because the pay is so low. And, you know, it's just not a living wage and it's very difficult work. I was wondering if maybe one of you had seen it or had thoughts about ways of approaching building a better wage for some of these important positions.
Yeah, we did a minimum wage and health report at Bar High a number of years back now, but I know a number of campaigns used in their minimum wage increase efforts across the state of California. I think that one way is for people to really understand the health impacts of the wage increases. I think that's really important to know. That's still on our website for people who would like to take a look at it. The other thing is sometimes nonprofits feel bound by the amount of grant funding available or sometimes have limits on what can be paid from the grants. And so I think that grant makers, whether they be government or private sector,
as much as they can encourage
living wage employment and make sure that they are not putting criteria in their contracts that actually limit local organizations' capacity to make living wage choices, I think is really important.
Melissa brings up a really good point. And I'm sure we could have a whole podcast series talking about philanthropy and foundation and the way that they could change the way they do business to really support community groups and community organizations. So I've been doing a little bit of research lately for a project related to community health workers and promotoras and community violence interrupters and all of those kinds of folks who like come from the community and work in the community to improve conditions. And one of the things that we're seeing there is funders seem to be very stuck in one specific way of looking at those folks and what they should be doing. And we're seeing a strong need to expand the scope of what community health workers can and should be doing. You probably would not be able to find stronger advocates in their respective community than community health workers and promotoras. And a lot of them do that work, but a lot of funders seem very focused on kind of the traditional way of those folks working as kind of conduits to connect folks to services or folks doing education and outreach. And I think it's important to kind of expand the way we think of different roles kind of hand in hand with some of the stuff Melissa was saying around, you know, not limiting what you can do with the funding that's available as well. I mean, we've also seen, particularly through the pandemic to right now, the high numbers of burnout and stress that healthcare workers and public health professionals, public health practitioners have been facing. And I think, you know, that also impacts advocates and folks that work at community organizations and folks like that. Like there's just so much going on that impacts those folks, especially the folks that are kind of on the front line. And we really need to kind of look at that and figure out what are the solutions you can put into place, right? Like it sometimes it feels like it needs to go beyond like employee assistance programs and things like that to really do what we can to support those folks. And one of those things is making sure we've got a living wage and benefits and, you know, flexible work schedule and things like that to really support these folks that are doing vital, vital things in the community, but might not be getting the support, whether it's financial or otherwise, to do what they need to do.
Yeah, Ruben, I really agree with you. And I think particularly for community health workers and street-based outreach and violence prevention workers, we have an opportunity to start to think about and understand those roles in the way we understood many public sector roles a generation and a half, two generations ago, where we saw them as paths to living wage employment. And the positions were structured and through unions and other strategies, really became living wage employment, even in some place as expensive as where we are. And so I think we haven't done that yet for community health workers or for violence prevention specialists. They probably should be on a scale that looks a lot more like police and fire, right? And so that's something for us to think about. I mean, I think the challenge, particularly for community health workers, is they tend to be in a field that people associate with social work, and social work has been underpaid for quite some time. And so also as the work around thinking about the care economy and really understanding the value of work that's done to support others, I think really could help also with those two professions, right? Hopefully that there will be some overflow in that way, the ways of thinking.
I think the way that we also value folks that do that kind of work, particularly folks who might have a high school degree or GED or less, and not valuing the work that they're doing, that's a white supremacist kind of perspective and a white supremacist practice. And we need to really pare that down and not think of things, not put as much value on a degree or an advanced degree. We're really talking about folks that have experience that is as valid, if not more valid, than folks that have those kinds of advanced degrees or professional, quote unquote, experience.
In the same way, we value executive networks, right? Valuing the networks that people are bringing to grassroots work.
What are some of the more creative cross-sectoral partnerships that you may have seen or been a part of? I love the partnerships around the eviction moratoriums during COVID-19, where we saw housing advocates and public health departments and others all together working on making sure there were eviction moratoriums so more people weren't being put out on the street in a moment where budgets were crunched, many things were uncertain. And so we saw public health departments across the Bay Area create health rationale. We did that on their behalf as well as their coalition, and shared that with groups that were focused on housing issues. In the couple of places, the handful of counties in the Bay Area where they had never passed before a countywide tenant protection, we worked to create local data sets for them so that they could see what the housing sort of housing concern calls were that were coming into housing support groups and legal aids, so that they could understand that the housing burdens were locally. And we saw, you know, COVID-19 eviction moratoriums in every Bay Area county to varying levels of strength, but without a doubt, hands down by multiple private researchers now who have taken a look at what eviction moratoriums had meant for the pandemic, there's a number of lives that were saved by that intervention. So we've seen just university after university studying both the eviction moratoriums and what happened when they were lifted. And I think that there are huge lessons for the field anytime there's a natural disaster, and then huge lessons anytime there's a major emergency response about the importance of housing to keeping people safe. And so that shouldn't be a surprise. There's some work being done right now on housing as a human right. But I think the work that got done during the pandemic can really pave a new way for people to understand that. So I think that's been a great thing.
One of the projects I'll mention really briefly is a project we had running called the Intersections Initiative, which was funded by the St. Joseph Community Partnership Fund, which was another learning community made up of community-based organizations and advocates and healthcare systems partners who were working together to explore roles that those kinds of more healthcare-focused partners can play in upstream prevention. And kind of during the process of this initiative, we recognize that developing partnerships and developing cross-sector partnerships in particular, they don't develop organically or holistically just because we have an initiative, we have the funding to be able to do it. And we saw how these partnerships that started with community-based organizations and healthcare or health systems, how those, they needed to kind of struggle and wrestle a little bit with big questions and have discussions on hard topics to get to that kind of shared foundation. And part of the journey for them was to be able to create the space and the resources for that partnership development to happen and to grow. And as each of those local collaboratives started identifying what they wanted to work on, with some that was around housing, with some that was around building resilience to combat trauma in their communities, for some it was a living wage and employment opportunity. And as they started identifying those challenges, they started bringing in other partners from other sectors, whether it was housing developers, employers, or other anchor institutions in the community, they ended up realizing that we can't measure success solely by identifying like how many new policies were passed and how much, you know, things like that. It really, one of the ways that they wanted to measure their success was how they were able to grow their table and increase the number of partners that they had that could engage in this work and could carry that work forward as well. Like, one of the important things about bringing together a collective, a collaborative, a coalition is not only doing the work and doing the work equitably, but also putting in place what you need to put in place so that the work can be sustainable in the long run.
The other thing that I found really interesting is to see different geographies start to build on each other's lessons. And I feel like that's happened so incredibly in the basic income, guaranteed income movement. And so we've seen the pilot work that happened in Jackson, Mississippi, and then Stockton, and then a handful of other places where there was some really strong evaluation about the impact of a cash aid to families unrestricted. And what they found included things like that those income payments were as effective as antidepressants because of the level of stress that they were reducing on the family. And then that movement has just grown, and there are just pilots many, many more places. Some of them funded by the federal resources came through during COVID, some by philanthropic resources. But the idea is people are finding the money in different places to get those pilots started. And then all of those pilots are adding up to a new way of understanding
the kinds of cash aid,
poverty alleviation that can really contribute to people's well-being. We have a model here in the Bay Area out of San Francisco, the Abundant Birth Project, that focuses in particular on Black and Pacific Islander moms and providing them with the resources they need to reduce stress during their pregnancy and early years. These kinds of models are really based on a lot of global research that shows this works. So it's nice to see us really then start to take that in here and start to build what's a whole movement around it. And so I think that kind of combination of work with social services and public health has been really interesting.
Ruben, I know you've done a lot of work in mental health and wellness. You could almost partner with anyone on building mental health and resilience and wellness. Do you have any thoughts about any particular relationships that you'd like to see built more for supporting mental health?
You know, that's a great question. And I'm going to kind of build on some of the comments Melissa made earlier around parks and Parks and Rec being like a vital partner in a lot of work that you see happening. A few years ago, we had a two-year project in Ohio where we were brought in by the state Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services to help the 10 rural counties with the highest rate of opioid overdose death to strengthen their focus on prevention. And so we worked with representatives from those 10 counties who came from community-based organizations, healthcare providers, and local alcohol and drug prevention boards to help them come up with some innovative strategies, innovative partnerships and solutions to address the opioid epidemic. In one of the counties, and it was Lawrence County, which some folks who are familiar with Ohio might know, the group that we were working with there identified that one of the biggest challenges that they were facing, one of the biggest drivers for the epidemic, was social isolation. And social isolation coming from, you know, a lack of employment opportunities, factory jobs and mines that had closed down, which led to people leaving the community in search of other jobs and leaving folks with frayed social networks, neighbors that they had known for decades no longer being there, things like that. And so as they started trying to think of the way that they could build up the kind of infrastructure for connection in their communities again, they decided to invite their local parks and rec department to join their coalition and started hatching these plans for how they could work together to develop opportunities for folks to, you know, come together in their local park, how they could start having more events in the local park. They were able to bring in the public health department to also be a part of these conversations. They had a stake in having open space for physical activity to address other chronic conditions. They were able to get some of the local employers in the area to come up and set up booths when they were looking to hire these folks. You know, so they were able to tie together a whole lot of different challenges and issues they were seeing and build on the strengths that they had already in the community around the way, you know, small communities, little community, everybody knew each other. And we're able to kind of bring those big players together so that they could do things to kind of start the connection between the residents again. And so it's just a great example of how, if you think outside of the box a little bit, just look at what in your community, you can come up with some really innovative solutions that'll address chronic conditions, that'll address mental health and the feeling of being isolated. It'll help to address some of those things that might be drivers for alcohol and drug use, kind of all kind of bound up together. And they've been really successful in the work that they've been doing over the last couple of years.
That's great to hear. And I want to thank you both for being here. We can wrap up, but if you want to share any last thoughts.
I didn't get to mention too much. You know, every couple of years, there's like a new hot topic, a new hot, you know, term or concept that everybody talks about. And right now it seems that the hot topic is ecosystems. It feels like everybody's talking about ecosystems. So we've been talking about it too. And it's kind of come out of some of the work that you've done around what it takes to have a equitable and just recovery from the pandemic. And one of the ways that we feel we can strengthen kind of our public health infrastructure to be more equity and racially just is through kind of this public health ecosystem model, where you kind of focus on everybody that kind of touches on the public health and have them all be part of this broad ecosystem. So it's not just about local government moving forward and doing the work or community-based organizations doing the work. It's about everybody doing the work together. And strengthening that infrastructure is not just about increasing funding to be able to do that work, which of course that's a really important part of it, but it's also about strengthening the relationships and the connections between all of those players.
Yeah, we've also been focusing on that idea of what does it take to have an equitable recovery. And so early on in the pandemic, we put out a report focused on equity and emergency response and laying out a vision for equity leads or equity officers in government who not only support response, but create long-term resilience to the partnerships they build in community. That model has been picked up across the state of California. And so it's actually a required part of the COVID relief funds that were awarded across jurisdictions. And so there are 60 equity officers now that are receiving training and capacity building to do that kind of long-term resilience building.
And so I'll also share with you that report and the model of trainings that are now out there and available for equity teams in government.
That would be great. Thank you so much. Thank you both, Melissa and Ruben, for being here. It's great to hear about your work.
Thank you, Allison.
Thank you.
This podcast is supported by the Western Region Public Health Training Center. The WRPHTC offers continuing education credit hours for certified health education specialists. If you are looking to obtain credits, please visit our learning portal at learn.wrphtc.arizona.edu and select the Keeping Up with Public Health podcast to take the post-evaluation survey for this episode. A transcript of this episode is also available on our learning portal. You can find more of our work at wrphtc.arizona.edu. You can also find us on LinkedIn, Instagram, and Twitter at WRPHTC. A special thank you to Eric Healy for his help in publishing the show and creating the music for each episode.